Hello, and welcome to Community Forum. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Today we're going to talk gardening, and with the onslaught of spring and early summer heat here in Anchorage, I think a lot of people are interested in this topic today. Our guests today are Julie Riley. She's a horticulturalist with the Cooperative Extension Service, and Kari Sherman, an environmental specialist with the Municipality of Anchorage's Rain Garden Program. Hi.
Hi, Ellen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and it's a beautiful afternoon, too. I spent quite a bit of time in my garden yesterday hauling out some old Shasta daisies that were taken over and getting that soil worked up so that I can start some new planting. So I was going to start off with you, Julie Riley. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Cooperative Extension Service does?
The Cooperative Extension Service is part of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and we're the university for the people. And in Anchorage, we have a horticulturalist, which is me. We have a home economist, and we have somebody in 4-H youth development, and then we have a water quality specialist.
Right. You work with kids, animals, and you give a lot of gardening advice to both backyard farmers and full-time farmers?
Commercial horticulture.
Commercial horticulture.
Yeah, I work just in Anchorage, so all the farmers are outside my district.
They are. I'm a farmer. I try to be a farmer. I think, in these days, people are interested in growing their own. I think it's part of the whole new green culture. People are jumping on that bandwagon, and I think that it's also a good way to save a little money.
Well, it's phenomenal, the interest that I've seen from, especially from young people. This is kind of a new phenomenon. It reminds me of the 70s all over again, but I actually had someone at the counter yesterday showing me pictures of their garden on their iPhone.
Right. And I think it's a refreshing and a very positive trend. In fact, only yesterday I pulled out some perennial plants that I had in a small garden outside one of the bedroom windows on the ground floor. And it occurred to me that if I put in some tomatoes and lettuce there, I could just reach out the window and pick. And I thought, wow, I'm going to do that.
I love it.
Breakfast in bed.
Breakfast in bed, I hope. Well, tomatoes and lettuce anyway. So what do you I'm going to address some general questions out there to the horticulturist among us. And is it hard to get a garden going? Big garden, small garden?
It's not hard. It's not hard in Anchorage at all. There's just a couple things you need to remember. Most soil that's never been fertilized is going to be low in nutrients. So you need to add nutrients in some form. And then I know it's been warm, but really, if you're a beginning gardener, I think you should stick with the cool season vegetables. So if you pick the right crops to grow, it's easy to be successful.
And what would the cool season vegetables be?
Well, anything that's in the cabbage family, which would include broccoli and cauliflower, kale, kohlrabi, and then there's peas. Peas grow really well. All the lettuces, the salad greens, arugula, mizuna, tatsoi, some of those new exciting gourmet salad greens, beets, carrots, turnips, onions, it goes on and on. So, there are just a few things that we don't do well with unless you have a greenhouse.
So, and that is changing, too. I mean, when I first came to Alaska, there was no hope to grow a pumpkin or a tomato outside of a greenhouse. But I've talked to people who swore they grew pumpkins without greenhouse.
Well, there's always a gardener that can do what you tell them that they cannot do. So with these warm season crops, you do usually need to use some warming techniques, clear plastic. You need to collect heat during the day when it's warm. So you need to, prune off flowers so that you only get one or two fruits per plant. And, of course, selecting the right variety makes a big difference.
So let's take some of these Alaska growing tips and see if they are workable or not workable. The things you hear are, The birch trees are leafing out. That means the soil is warm enough to plant. Is that a truism or a falsism?
I knew I should have grabbed a soil thermometer yesterday. I think that it's a good indication that we can plant, especially seeds. So I have a couple of master gardeners that are going to determine this year the value of the produce that they grow on a community garden site. So they're going to count all their inputs, the cost of a package of seed and seed potatoes and renting a rototiller, everything that goes into the garden, and then they're going to weigh and count everything that comes out of the garden and check grocery store prices, check farmers market prices, and see what they can actually grow. And they've got their entire garden planted May 11th. I think that's got to be a record for Anchorage.
That's quite early, although I was going to get to that. The June 1st, don't plant before June 1st rule. I think, is it safe to break that rule, especially this year?
Oh, I think definitely. You know, if you can get a couple of weeks extra up front in a season, that's the way to go. You know, we can have a killing frost. We've had two killing frosts in, you know, the warmer parts of town on Memorial Day weekend and in the last 25 years, you know, that I have been here. Mm. So we could still have a killing frost, but if you're putting your seeds out or those crops that really like cool temperatures, like onions and perhaps leeks, you'll be fine. You know, it's just the things you put in as transplants or any of the warm season crops that aren't going to like cold soil temperatures.
So I think our soil, when generally does the soil warm enough? What is the signal that the soil, how deep does the soil have to be warm support the seedlings?
Most vegetables, even when they're mature in Anchorage, aren't going to have roots much below, 10 inches. So, people that do a raised bed garden, on top of an existing lawn or in a driveway, use 1x12s, and that's about 10 inches of soil, and you do fine. So, when you're putting that little transplant in, you're only down a couple of inches. So when the soil temperatures reach, 45 degrees, you can plant spinach and peas. When it hits 55, you can plant a lot of other things, and then warm season crops like beans and zucchini and those outdoor tomato varieties, would like it warmer, but some years it doesn't get it doesn't get into the ideal range is what I'm thinking.
Let's pause just a moment to remind our listeners that this is Community Forum, and it's a call-in show. So if you have any questions for our horticulturist and our environmental specialist here, call 550-8433, 550-8433, or outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, or send us an email at communityforum@kska.org. I'm speaking today with Julie Riley with the Cooperative Extension Service and with Kari Sherman, who is with the Municipality of Anchorage Rain Garden Program, and we'll hear more about rain gardens in just a few minutes. But I was going to ask you, Julie, what exactly does determine a kind of vegetable that's good for Alaska? We hear about root crops, carrots, and potatoes especially. You mentioned earlier zucchini. Zucchini seem to be doing really well up here no matter what.
Well, it's the optimum temperature for growth. So the cool season, crops, and that includes flowers too. I mean, that's why we can grow such great lobelia and pansies compared to, Texas and warmer climates. So some plants, would like to have daytime temperatures in the 60s, and others would like to have daytime temperatures in the 70s. And then, same holds true for the evening. The warm season crops would like temperatures in the 60s, and the cool season plants can go down into the 40s without being affected by those cool temperatures.
Right. And how about you hear a lot of things, because I've been in Alaska quite a while, and what was true maybe 25, 30 years ago has really changed. Like, my neighbors have apple trees, fruit trees. I'm planning to put in a fruit tree this summer. Is something more benign in the climate lately? Do you keep track of those things?
Well, I think that in terms of fruit trees, we've just done more experimenting. In terms of climate shifts in the last 25 years, I can't really say. I do know we've only had two temperatures above 70 last summer. You know, so we've already had more warm days this spring than we did for the entire year last season. But we had some really warm summers in the last five. When I moved up here in 84, I didn't put on a short-sleeved shirt the whole season. I was waiting for it to warm up. So I don't know. Every year is different.
Well, let's take a couple of phone calls right now. Let's go to line 8, please. Okay. Hello, Gail, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, what's your question?
I am new to Anchorage, and I've moved into a house. It has lots of planter boxes left over from the former owner, but I don't know what condition the soil is in, and I wanted to perch or obtain soil. Other than going to some place like Fred Meyer's, is there a place like that I can get, a station wagon load full of soil, perhaps from the state or from some other source where it's not going to cost very much money?
Well, you can purchase what we call topsoil in bulk. And so you go to the Yellow Pages and look up topsoil, and there's really only a handful of companies that sell topsoil. So it is possible. I will caution you, not to shovel this soil into garbage cans because you won't be able to lift them up into your station wagon. You're going to have to use 5-gallon buckets. So another idea, there is a Garden Snaps map that was published this year that has lots of the greenhouses and nurseries. Many of them sell soil, some of them in bulk, so you could get that by calling my office or coming in. Many of the greenhouses and nurseries have that map. It's called the Garden Snaps map.
And your office is located?
The Cooperative Extension Service in Anchorage is at 2221 East Northern Lights, which is on Northern Lights and Lake Otis behind Medical Park.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Gail. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Rich, and he's dying to ask the same question I've been wanting to ask, but we'll let him ask it. Are you there, Rich?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question has to do with the ash fall, and I'm just wondering what kind of nutrients it's adding, and is it primarily alkaline or acidic? Can I back off on lime on my lawn this year? Do I have to put more on? That kind of thing. And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay. Well, the last time we had a big ash fall, the nutrients in that ash were so tied up that we're not going to see those nutrients in our lifetime. And it was not especially acidic or alkaline. It was pretty close. It was a little bit on the acidic side, but pretty close to neutral. So essentially, it wasn't a big benefit to gardeners. And I will say that I have been collecting little sweepings of ash, trying to get enough so that we can actually test this ash fall. So I need 1 to 2 cups, which is hard to come by in Anchorage. So I'm almost there.
I have some I can contribute.
Good, good.
I was just going to say that when I moved up to Anchorage from Cordova in 92, that was after the big spur eruption, and I must have had an inch of that stuff. And it was really dark, very rich, dark stuff. And I was told, it was good for the soil, but I really couldn't see where it did anything. And now the stuff I collected from Readout is very light, very pale gray, so it's a different composition.
Yeah, and particle size makes a difference, too, in terms of, what type of soil amendment it would be, if it would help, serve as essentially a bulking agent where it could help to break up a heavier soil. So it really depends on the particle size as well as the composition of the ash.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not expecting that it's going to be a big benefit. But back to your lawn, you don't need to lime every year. If you've been doing that regularly, you're probably good. But some of the greenhouses will do a free pH test as a public service and let you know if you do need to add lime this year.
Okay, thanks for calling. And that was Rich. And let's go to line 5. Carolyn, are you there?
Yes, hi, this is Caroline. I wanted to shine a light on some of the other programs of cooperative extension. I've been telling my daughter all about it, and she lives in Vermont. So this is still a federal program that's nationwide, isn't it?
In Alaska, about 25% of our funding is federal. The rest of our funds come to the university through the state legislature, and that's where the cooperative in the name comes from. We don't really have much of a local funding component, and other states do have local government funding.
Okay, good, because I know that I took a course from Ms. Shawcross, something of that name.
Yeah, Leslie Shawcross.
Yes, yes. And it was about canning, and I canned hot water canning when I was a 4-H'er growing up in Florida. But this had to do with canning meats and fish. And it was last summer when the gasoline prices were going through the roof, and there was a pretty good turnout. I saw it again announced recently, but unfortunately I didn't see it until the day off. But some of those programs, canning meat and fish and some of the other things you have, I just wondered if you could mention them, because I know you folks work with 4-H and all that other stuff, because it does a lot more than most people realize.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Leslie does have I believe it is a canning fish and meats class this month. She had one on Monday night that had good participation, so I would suggest if you're interested for more info to call my office, because I've been so busy in horticulture, I haven't kept up with the particulars in the home economics arena. So
yeah.
The number there is 786-6300, and we answer the phone till 4:30.
Thank you for all the good work. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Carolyn. Let's take one more call from Jay. Jay, are you there? Jay? Line one? No, he's gone. Sorry, he had a good question about tomatoes. Well, let's hear, take a break from the cooperative extension for just a moment, and let's talk to Carrie Sherman here. And she's here to tell us about a new kind of garden. At least it's new to me. So what is a rain garden exactly, Carrie?
Rain gardens are they're a new type of green infrastructure. They're not it's basically doing what we've always done, but making sure we do it intentionally in the right way. A rain garden is a shallow. It's just like any other garden, except for instead of making a raised bed, you make it a shallow depression in the landscape where it can collect runoff from your roof, driveway, or other impervious surface around your house, or even a large parking lot or a large industrial building. For larger areas, you have larger gardens that can collect more runoff, and then you have about 12 inches of gravel at the bottom of your garden that will ensure really good drainage through these rain gardens. And by planting hardy native plants and perennials, the runoff will then be collected to your garden, pool on the top, and filter through after a heavy rain event. And it'll cut down on runoff and pollution and save money on municipal maintenance in our storm drain systems.
So why is it important to filter that roof runoff? That's hard to say. Roof runoff. Why is that?
A lot of roofs are made of metal, and so they have zinc and heavy metals in them. Also, just the quantity of runoff when we bring urbanization to an area that used to be covered in wetlands, as Anchorage used to be, or forests, all the forest used to hold and collect water and function just like this rain garden is. And when we put even a roof that has no potential toxic things that are going to run off of it, it's just the quantity of water that now runs off your roof into the street can causes increased flooding and faster, higher peak flows. So even in that sense.
So this way you can take that drip and or position a garden underneath a drippy area or a rain gutter that funnels down directly into the street, and put a garden there as sort of a barrier, and the water will run into this garden, and hopefully the plants in the garden that you're going to plant will filter out impurities. How does that work?
That's sort of a horticulture question when it gets to the science of the soils, but the microorganisms in the soil are able to... I know it's a good process. I mean, do you know the scientists of how they really take the pollutants out?
Yeah. Well, I should. Well, we don't want to get too scientific, but
we just don't want them to get into the waterways.
Right.
So filtering into the soil and what the plants are doing is they also utilize the water,
mm-hmm.
and they will take up some of the heavy metals and hold them, you know, in their tissue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the way I understand rain garden, it's mostly to, you know, to keep pollutants out of the water systems and tie it up in the soil. Mm-hmm. Where, as you said, carry the soil microorganisms can break down some of the toxins.
Okay. Right. And Kari was actually at my house and reviewing my selected area, which actually was not under one of my roofs. It was under my next door garage's roof because it's right there on the lot line. But what's the idea? You want to put in native plants? One of the recommendations for building a rain garden is to utilize native plants, like not annuals that you would buy at one of the grocery stores, something that
right.
would come back. Tell me about that.
Part of the added bonus of making a rain garden is that it's low maintenance. So if you do use native plants that are already adaptive for our environment, they're going to have a better chance to survive, because this is going to be potential flood and drought situation. And also, I mean, just hardy perennials, that's because we're saying that it could be a more challenging environment if you're bringing in a flood and letting 4 to 8 inches of water sit on top of these plants for somewhere between 12 and 24 hours when we have a really heavy rain event. Anchorage usually has these low-intensity rain events, and so it won't be quite so often that they're flooded. But I guess we just use the native plant seed varieties because they're already adapted to this sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our native iris setosa is such an incredible plant because it's well adapted to the regular garden with dry soils. But when you drive by a Klutna Flats in the winter and stop and look at the iris there along the road, they're growing in solid ice. You know, that has salt in the water even. So they're amazing plants. So that's a good example of a bimodal plant, a plant that can take it dry and can take it wet as well.
Right. And I've also heard, I don't want to get too far off the subject of rain gardens right now, but I've also heard that sunflowers are a wonderful plant for actually removing toxins from the soil. But getting back, and I'll get hold that thought on the irises a moment. Getting back to the rain garden, what the city's making it pretty easy for people to construct them. They have quite a bit of literature, this little pamphlet that says six easy steps. Tell us about the six easy. Other the digging part is not going to be an easy step, but other than that, it shouldn't be too hard.
The six easy steps brochure takes the original manual that we put out that was nearly 30 pages and breaks it down into six paragraphs on how to build your rain garden and get reimbursed. And for the basic garden, this is going to be enough information. For the residential size, it starts with information about our program and then tells you what the process is going to be to go through. The first part is that we have a grant application that you can get online. And then once you've determined that you think you do probably want a rain garden, I will come out and we will walk around your property and do what we call an initial site visit. This initial site visit, we size and site the rain garden and pick out the best locations and an approximate size range for your garden. Once you've chosen your site, we've sized your garden, then you're off on the construction process. And in that point, you purchase all your materials up front 100% in full. You follow this guidance in the manual. And then at the final inspection, when I return again, you give me a ring, you say, I finished my garden. We come out, we do an inspection, and you can submit your receipts. And that's basically what this brochure goes through on how to get reimbursed. For these residential gardens, we reimburse, like I said, this program, we reimburse you for your costs, half your costs, up to $750. So if you spend $1,500, we will return to you $750. And that's our limit for the residential program. However, we do negotiate on a one-on-one project for these larger parking lots or industrial sites if you wanted to do a larger garden.
Right, and you can get all these six steps plus a list of plants that are recommended for planting in your rain garden on the Muni.
The Muni website is anchoragerraingardens.com.
And that website and all our other links are our website links to the Cooperative Extension Service can be found on KSKA.org. And just a brief moment here to remind our listeners, this is a call-in program. So if you have questions about gardening, gardening tips, or rain gardens, call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. And I'm going to get my roll up my sleeves and I'm going to build me a rain garden this summer in a patch of my yard that has been just crying out for floral enhancement all these years. And I've had my lawnmower and wheelbarrow stacked there. And every summer I go by that and think it would be so much nicer if it was a little garden there. So I'm going with the rain garden thing. And I'm going to talk a little bit now about turning your floral gardens into a vegetable garden. Is this something that's becoming more of a trend? Because I've seen it done. There was a gentleman down the street from me years ago, and he had his whole front lawn a vegetable garden. And at the time, you know, people thought that was a little nutty, but I had to give him a big attaboy because he was using that land. He was a Japanese fellow, and when I went to Japan, I realized that if people had a piece of ground big enough to put a cabbage in, by gum, there was a cabbage in that piece of ground. So tell me, Julie, I know there was a front yard gardening class given not too long ago.
Yeah, a front yard farming, and there's going to be another class on May 27th. So people, it's a free class taught by four master gardeners, and all people need to do to register is call my office. But vegetable gardening has definitely become a trend. I first started seeing a change in the year 2000, so I thought it was the new millennium that kind of ushered that in. But the last few years, there's been a lot of excitement about eating locally and growing your own food. And I think the internet community has had a hand in helping to push along this movement.
I think it's a great idea. I think the Obamas are behind it. They've got that White House garden. And like I said, I thought, why? I have this perfect little patch of soil that has had nothing in it all these years except some little petunias and stuff. And it's probably with a little help, I could just get my lettuce and carrots and peas in there and have them right next to the house. Or an herb garden, too.
I mean, right. I volunteer in the herb garden out at the Alaska Botanical Garden, and there's almost 100 different kinds of herbs growing out there. So not all of them are perennial. About half of the plants come back every year. So we just have to grow the things that are winter hardy for us and put the rest of them in pots and grow them as houseplants.
Let's take a break and go to the phones because we have a couple of rain garden questions coming in. How about line two? Hi, Michelle.
Yep, this is Michelle.
Okay, go for it.
Last fall, I collected seeds from wild lupin, and I've started them from seed, and they're a couple of inches tall now. I'm wondering if lupin is something that would be good to put in a rain garden, or what part of my yard I should put it in when I get them ready to put outside.
I think that the lupin, since you said you collected it, I know they just grow like crazy along the roads. And from our standpoint, we're still doing a little experimenting on the most recommended plants for our rain gardens. But a lupin seems to be one of these. Is it native? Is it?
Yeah, it's
a native plant. And I think that absolutely it would be a great thing to try out in the rain garden. I think it would do pretty good.
Yeah, I'd give it a try, along with those Alaskan wild iris.
Wild iris, too. Okay.
And speaking of the irises, the Alaska Plant Materials Center has donated a huge amount of native seeds to the rain garden program, and irises are one of those seeds. So if you choose to put in a rain garden, we do have iris seeds available, too.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Thanks, Michelle. Let's go to line three. Deb, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, you have a rain garden question for us.
Well, I think it sounds like a great idea. My question is, though, is that standing water in the woods usually breeds mosquitoes. So what do you do to prevent that being a problem?
You know, I think mosquitoes need something like, it's 48 or more hours for their breeding period process. And so these rain gardens are designed to infiltrate. That's how we size them based on the area that will run into them. And so they're designed to drain within 12 to 24 hours before mosquitoes could grow. Through that process.
Okay, because, you know, you don't want to be creating an environment for them.
Absolutely. And sometimes rain gardens can be used to remedy issues if you do have standing water.
Oh, how is that?
Well, you can put in a place that will take up that runoff and add that extra gravel so it infiltrates better. You might need to do, if you have the poor draining soil, as a under-drained pipe, but in essence, the rain gardens are designed to drain the extra runoff that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah. Mine are just coming out of the trees of the woods.
Yeah, and then there's that situation, so you probably have highly clay soil and just move it on.
Well, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Deb. I'm going to try Crane's Bill and the irises because I got to tell you this, Julie. I have rescue irises in my garden, and this is a long story, but I did dig up a beautiful clump of irises that were in line of a backhoe. And I went down there at 11 o'clock at night the night before and dug them up, dragged them home, replanted them. They did great. And then when I did a construction around my house, I had to replant them again and transplant them again in May, and that was bad. But it took 2 years, but the roots came back, and they are prolific now. And now I have this patch just full of those beautiful blue flag wild irises. And it isn't even a particularly swampy area, but they're thriving. So I think they'll really do well in the rain garden.
Yeah, I think it's an ideal plant.
Yeah, I would think so too. Let's take a real short break now and regroup our thoughts because I have plenty of emails coming in. Welcome back to Community Forum. I'm Ellen Lockyer, and my guests today are Julie Riley, a horticulturist with the Cooperative Extension Service, and Kari Sherman, who is an environmental specialist with the Municipality of Anchorage Rain Garden Program. So we have been talking sort of all around about just about everything you can grow here, and I would like to get back to the idea of growing your own vegetables as not only a source of recreation, but as a source of food and a source of, saving a little money. So let's go to line 10. We have a caller. Nancy?
Hello.
Hi. You're on air. What's your question?
More of a comment. I transformed some of my lawn to a vegetable garden, and it's been wonderful, but we still have moose that come in and love the cabbage.
Got to move the cabbage up on the deck under the second story of the house to keep them away, I'm afraid.
Okay. Yeah, it was very interesting. We had beautiful heads of cabbage, and the moose came in, and, you know, half of them would be chomped off, and
yeah, they love peas, too. You could try carrots. You could try beets. You could try potatoes. With potatoes, they just would stomp around on them, but they're not really going to be eating them like they do the cabbage and the broccoli and the peas.
So how do you protect them, then, the cabbage or those plants?
Well, either you have to put up a tall fence, which might not be practical. One of the master gardeners in town, Jane Baldwin, has been using pinwheels. You know, they're they're shiny and they make a little bit of noise. And so I think we all need to buy pinwheels this season.
That's a great idea. I never thought of that.
Well, the other thing is the crab apples and stuff like that. I know that I've got a tree out here that's been, it's years old, but they chomp on that every year too. So I'm thinking I should put a fence around that.
Yeah, you're gonna have to cage it in. The crab apples, the twigs and even the bark are just like candy to moose, it seems.
They're candy, yeah. I've got lots of pictures of moose.
Well, you're not alone. You're not alone, Nancy. The moose have gotten my cabbages, every single one. For years. But they enjoy them so much.
So get it.
I enjoy seeing the moose, so yeah. It's not a big deal, but, you know.
So get a 5-gallon bucket, put one cabbage in a 5-gallon bucket, and put it someplace that the moose can't reach it.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's idea. Now we're getting into container gardening. And
I know.
Right.
Same with everything, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Well, I have to say that last year, of my 6 cabbages, the moose got 5, but they did leave me 1, and it was the most perfect little head of cabbage. And because it was scarce and because it was my own, it was, I think, twice as delicious.
That's great.
We devoured it. Well, a little bit earlier, we had been talking about some of the Alaska gardening myths, and I wanted to read an email that just came in from Hillary. And she has a corn question, and this is, again, one of the great debates in Alaska gardening. Can you grow corn in Alaska? And Hillary says, my boyfriend is from the Midwest, and he's a big corn lover, and he's determined to try to grow his own corn this year, despite me telling him it's doomed for failure and a waste of garden space. I can almost hear the argument right now. Neither of us are experienced gardeners. Is there a way to get corn to grow in Alaska? Or is he setting himself up for a disappointment? What do you think, Julie?
It can be done. And given the head start that we've got on summer, it's possible. You need to start with very short season varieties like a Polar V, so the ears aren't going to be large. You need to use soil warming techniques. Just put down a piece of clear plastic and you'll raise the soil temperature up 10 degrees. Some people even start their corn indoors, and if he's from the Midwest, he's probably never done that before. And then perhaps using floating row cover to keep them a little bit warmer earlier in the season. But I will tell you that on Friday from noon to 1:30, Annie Neveldine and I are going to be doing a vegetable gardening class, and she has illustrated a harvest song with Alaskan pictures. And she has a picture of corn that was taken in Anchorage last summer. So it can be done with a lot of work. The other thing is corn is usually wind-pollinated, so if you don't have a lot of corn, you may have to do some hand pollination, because each one of those little silks runs to a kernel, and if pollen doesn't fall on the silk, then the kernel does not plump out the way it's supposed to.
Huh. Well, I have to add that I did grow 6 stalks one year. On that very hot year we had about 5 years ago, we did have a really hot summer, and I got lots of tassels, and I think I got a couple of really teeny-weeny, eeny little 1-inch corn ears, the kind you see pickled in cocktails. But I've heard of people growing corn here.
I'm from the Midwest myself, and I remember, back in the 80s going out to Palmer, to the Dearborn Farm, and having them open the door, to a greenhouse, which was a plastic-covered frame with a wood-burning stove in it, and there was a field of corn. And I thought, here I am in Alaska, and they're growing fields of corn under plastic.
Wow.
Using wood heat.
Well, out at the agricultural, the experimental farm in Palmer, they are growing vegetables in these sort of giant Quonset hut kind of things with plastic covering, and apparently
they're called hoop houses.
Hoop houses.
Yeah.
There you go. And some of the other myths are you can't grow a tomato in Alaska without a greenhouse. And there's a tomato question right here from a listener. And what nutrients do I need to produce fruit? Last year my tomatoes had lots of leaves and no fruit.
Well, if the plants looked healthy, if the foliage looked healthy, then it might not be a matter of of nutrients. It could have been light. It could have been temperature. Usually, I recommend a high phosphorus fertilizer for tomatoes, so that's the middle number. So bone meal, if you're going to do your tomatoes in containers, you know, make sure to throw in a handful of bone meal into that 5-gallon bucket, or even mix bone meal. Or, you know, some of the fish meals are high in phosphorus as well, right into the transplant hole.
I've tried the tomatoes in pots thing.
Yeah.
And didn't really get too far. I got very small, very small.
So, variety is, really important. You're not going to grow, you know, big boy and beefsteak outside, you know, even early girl. Is not, you have to, you know, you have to stick with those varieties that will set fruit under cooler temperatures.
I love the way you roll those names off your tongue, big boy and early girl.
Well, those I stumbled on because it's been a while. You know, it's more like Glacier and Siberian was a big one here, but don't grow Siberian tomatoes. They're not very productive or very tasty.
Yeah, but, you know, that's good because all of those titles of the tomatoes never meant anything to me. I had no idea which was what. But some of the best tomatoes, indoor tomatoes I've ever seen were in a living room in Kodiak, really. Which doesn't get a whole lot of sun anyway. And I have actually sent for the upside-down tomato grower.
Oh, I knew that was going to come up today. I knew it.
What do you think of that? I feel totally suckered. It comes in on every credit card statement I get. And they're over there at Walmart. Dirt cheap, too. No pun intended.
Okay.
What do you
think? More power to you.
I'm gonna give it a shot.
Sure, they'll grow. You know what I would do, Ellen, though, is pick a variety that's going to be determinate in its growth. You don't want one that wants to be 10 feet tall because it's got a because of the hormones in the plant, it's going to turn around and grow back up again. And if it goes up for 10 feet after having that curve down at the base, I'm worried it'll snap off. But this is about the third summer for the, you know, the upside down tomatoes. So it you can do it.
I won't try the big boy or the early girl crashing down from the ceiling laden with fruit. So let's go to the phones. We have six. Hi, Stu.
Hi.
Are you there? You've been holding a long time.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Crab apples.
Go ahead.
I have some crab apple seeds from a very successful tree outside my door. We harvested crab apples in October, and the jam was really good, better than all our berry jams that disappeared really quick. So I saved some of the seeds from these little apples, and I left them drying out on my windowsill, and they're still there. And I'm just wondering, do I have to let them dry for, like, how long, or what do you recommend?
Well, your chances of getting an apple similar to the one that you like so well are pretty slim.
Really?
So really what you need to do is collect some cyanwood, take cuttings from the tree, and then next year, when the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers do their apple grafting workshop, it's usually the first part of April, is graft some of those it's called cyanwood. They're twigs onto a winter hardy rootstock. So all the apples that you buy are grafted. Most of them, all of the eating apples. But even it's the Siberian crab apple is one of the rootstocks that's used. So if you know what kind of crab apple it is, we could probably figure out whether it was on its own roots or not. But chances are that it's not, that it's been a grafted plant.
So crab apples are also grafted.
A lot of them are. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was wondering why it's so much more successful than the, you know, we have the other apples in Eagle River, and they didn't produce very well last year because of the weather, but the crab apples just thrived. So I thought maybe this might be one of the ones that, okay, so it probably has to be grafted, so taking the seeds is probably not going to work.
Well, if it was a Siberian crab apple, that is a tree that's on its own roots, but most of the variety...
Okay, so maybe it is. Okay,
yeah.
I'll have to... So how do I find that out? I just get a book and look at the leaves?
The leaves are all going to look the same. The Siberian crab is a big tree, a very big tree with white flowers.
Yeah, it has white flowers. I mean, they're not out yet, but it does get white flowers. And it's about it's only been there like 4 years, and it's already 18 feet high.
Yeah. Well, most of the crabs that are sold in Anchorage, at least, are not the Siberian, unfortunately. Huh. But you can give it. You can give it a try.
Okay. Well, it doesn't cost anything. It's just going to take how many years to grow?
Well, what I would do is, you know, get in touch with the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers because they have wonderful programs, and then you can learn to propagate that tree, you know, vegetatively.
Okay, because it's
sure
a successful one.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot.
There you go. I never knew about Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers. Thank you. Thank you, Stu. I would like to take a brief moment to remind our listeners that if they have questions for either of our guests, they can call 550-8433, or outside Anchorage 1-888-353-5752, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. Don't forget, if you have any questions off air, go to kska.org to find links to the Municipal Rain Garden website or the Cooperative Extension website. Or, and one more caveat here, if you are listening to this program this evening, it's rebroadcast at 10, do not call because there won't be anyone here to answer your phone because it's a rebroadcast. So let's get back to some of our Alaska gardening tricks. And we have an email here about raised beds. You're always hearing how raised beds are the way to go in Alaska. And Jana asks us that she has a raised bed that hasn't been planted in about 4 years, and she's intending to plant this year, but it's all full of dandelions and weeds and tall grasses. What a surprise! My question is, do I simply till it and throw away the big clumps of weeds and then plant, or how else should I treat the existing soil? Should I just add new soil or treat the existing soil after she pulls out the dandelions?
Yeah, I would, you know, I would manually, you know, remove the dandelions and the grasses. And it's going to be hard work, but you can do it. The dandelions, if you, you know, chop them up with a rototiller, they'll just make many more dandelions than that one. So you've got a big seed bank of weeds in there, unfortunately. There is an organic a product that's corn gluten that is a pre-emergent weed killer. It also is 9% nitrogen. So after you go through all that work of hand removing the weeds and plant your transplants, when your seedlings are after your seedlings are up, you could use corn gluten to try to keep any of the existing seeds that are in the soil from germinating, or you can use a mulch.
And mulch, give us the definition of mulch.
Well, a mulch is a material that you lay on the surface of the soil. And you're doing that to prevent weeds, you know, by keeping the sun off, or to retain moisture. And Carrie and I were talking earlier about using mulch in our rain gardens. And I think this rain garden, I have to say this, I know I'm off topic, but this idea that somebody would actually pay you to make a garden is phenomenal.
Isn't
so
that
this,
cool?
Yeah, so this rain garden program that the city has is fabulous.
Well, let's go to the phone because line seven has got a rain garden question. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
You're on air.
I am so glad. And I don't really have a question, but I do have information on a rain garden in New Mexico, where we're originally from. We have a lot of rain at one time and very little at other parts of the year. So we do make rain gardens. And what we do is find an area that rains off of the watershed, the roof, the whatever. We dig a hole that is probably 2 or 3 feet deep.
Yep.
And on top of that, We do a number of different things. It mm-hmm. depends on how large you want it. Again, this is the same as what you do here.
Oh yeah.
We measure out how much we think is going to be in the rain. We put down mulch, then we put down what is it called? I can't think of what it's the black.
It's topsoil?
Not, pardon?
Black?
Landscape fabric.
Yeah. Oh. It's black. We use it in when you're purifying water.
Iodine?
No.
Well, it'll come to
I keep wanting to say stone, but it's not stone. It could be. It could be volcanic. But you put that down, and then you put down just red brick or just gravel. On top of that, you put good soil, and then you plant your seeds or whatever you're going to have in your garden on top of that.
Yep.
And the idea is that this rain is going to come down in such quantities that the plants that you plant are going to use only a portion of this rain that comes down. The rest of it is going to go down into this. It's like a cistern, but it's not a cistern.
Yep, yep.
And it's there only to use because you can use it throughout the rest of your area just by using PVC pipe or whatever to have the water go.
Okay. Do you line the bottoms of your gardens to hold the water
in? Right.
Okay. So this is a different aspect where you're trying to make sure the water gets out and back into the groundwater system. So it's a groundwater recharge effect.
Well, in one way. However, when we have large amounts of land or more than just one for one little house, we have these because not every area in the yard is going to get a lot of rain. So we have these so that this water can be utilized in areas that you want to have more water in.
It's great. It's like you're creating a rain barrel that has pre-filtered and pre-treated water.
Exactly. And it's perfect. We have bamboo that's growing, and so we'll take the bamboo that's where, because we have a lot of runoff, and we'll put the bamboo stalks. It'll go into the growing bamboo. And then we take the dead bamboo stalks on the other side, and we'll dig a hole. And we'll have the bamboo laying down as a cross grid. On top of that, you put your volcanic stone or...
Okay, that's how you make sure to filter the water at the bottom.
Right, exactly.
That's a fascinating technique to use to create a different effect for these rain gardens, but I think it's...
It really works.
This is the Anchorage program, and that's a New Mexico technique, and that's really cool. Thanks for sharing
it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mary. We got a bunch of calls I want to get in. Thanks for calling with your comments. Let's go to Sarah on line 9, please.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for doing this program. My question pertains to slugs. I attempted a vegetable garden, succeeded with some beautiful zucchinis, and found them to be annihilated by some slugs. And the same thing happened to my lilies after I gave up the zucchini and just went with the flowers. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, you have to. I'm glad you're thinking slugs in May, because usually... we get complacent. We don't see a lot of damage the first part of the season in June, and then they're there in July and August and do a lot of damage. There is a very easy product to use that's organic. The active ingredient is iron phosphate, and it comes under a number of different brand names. One of them is Sluggo, but I think there are some other products out there, and it's very effective against slugs. You can use all sorts of traps. They do like beer, it's true. But you have to be vigilant, because if you had them last year and with the snow cover that we had, it's going to be another banner year for slugs, I'm afraid.
Okay. So Slug Gold or Slug Go is the product?
But what you're looking for is the active ingredient is iron phosphate.
Okay.
So anybody that sells organic... products for insect control will carry it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for calling. Let's go to line 8. Diane?
Hi.
Hi, Diane.
Yes, I just want to let you know that beer does work. I put out a little a dish that it just at the level of the dirt, and it seemed to work. I don't know when I should expect them, if I should try and maybe head them off right now and put it out there. But anyway, I really called on Equus. Is there anything new?
Equisetum, the horsetail?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, where have you got it? In the lawn, in the garden?
And mainly the garden that I'm concerned about.
Okay. Well, it is possible to eliminate the horsetail just by cutting it off, you know, tilling it under. If it was in your lawn, you could just mow the lawn and it goes away. But it, you know, we've just got so many of the spores in the environment. You know, it's one of our native plants, so it's in the woods everywhere. So it does get into the garden every year. You just have to be diligent. You have to starve it out. You have to, you know, not let it stay green. And if it can't stay green, then it won't grow. So I know every year it's just a hassle. There's no magic, no silver bullet here, I guess.
I do have a pile of soil that actually came to me in. I didn't realize that it was full of that when I ordered this topsoil. What if I take one of the propane weed burners and, you know, just burn the heck out of it? Would I get rid of the spores, or it's a waste of time because they're just everywhere?
No. that'll work. It'll keep resprouting. Until you've essentially depleted its food reserves. But a weed burner works great. Just don't start your raised bed on fire.
Yeah, and just a reminder that there is an extensive burn ban in effect right now. Don't touch that propane torch for a while. Wait till a rainy day. Thanks, Diane. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want to get in something real quick. We talked about the horsetail, and that is a native plant that's very, very invasive, the butter and eggs. What's the difference between, like, the irises you talked about, Julie, are extremely invasive. They will just spread all over the place, and so the cranesbill. What's the difference between, say, an invasive weed and an invasive native plant? Is there
Well, I know what you're saying. To the gardener, many plants are aggressive, and we think of them as invasive. But in the way that invasive is being used in recent years has to do with non-native plants that have the ability to get into natural systems and just muck up the ecosystems by taking hold in natural environments where they don't belong. So really, you know, from a land manager's standpoint, the invasive plant is a non-native plant, you know, that's causing destruction to habitat or to the environment. And in the garden, we've got to, I suppose, just kind of shift gears and talk about aggressive plants rather than invasives.
Okay, I dug up some cranesbill, which I love, out of the woods. Now they're all over my backyard. I think I had two to begin with, and now I have hundreds. So we have got very little time left, maybe 30 seconds. Kari, anything you want to share about the rain garden real quick?
The rain garden program is a 50-50 match fund by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and we just wanted to say thank you to them. And also, if you're a school interested in doing a rain garden with your students, that is a really great opportunity there, too.
Okay. I'd like to say thanks to my guests, Kari Sherman and Julie Riley. If you've got any more information you'd like about today's show, check out kska.org. All of the information is on our website. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Thanks for listening to Community Forum.
Community Forum is a production of KSKA's News and Public Affairs Department. Opinions expressed are those of the guest, host, and callers, and do not represent the views of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Community Forum on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to additional information on today's topic, including all the websites mentioned on today's show. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write to us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email communityforum@kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.